This message is brought to you by DoNotAge.org, the longevity research organisation that's on a mission to extend health span for as many people as possible via products that actually work. Start your journey today at DoNotAge.org and use code LAMA for a 10% discount. That's LLAMA.
I'm going to need my body for a while, and so I do think it's incredibly important to treat it well. I also, as a futurist and technologist, think, though, that I'm among the first generation that will have the choice maybe to live forever if they want to.
Hello and welcome to the Live Long and Master Aging podcast. I'm Peter Bowes. This is where we explore the science and stories behind human longevity. This is another episode from the TED Med conference held recently in La Quinta in California, the mass brainstorming session where some of the biggest thinkers in the health and medical fields get together to share their wisdom, ideas, and inspiration. So here's the question of the day. What if we could learn from the collective insights of every doctor in the world? Now just think about that. It's almost inconceivable, but maybe not. I'm delighted to welcome to the podcast Kevin Lyman. Kevin is the Chief Operating Officer and Lead Scientist at Enlytic, a San Francisco-based medical company, deep learning company with a mission to improve healthcare around the world, and it's been described by MIT Tech Review as one of the world's 50 smartest companies. Kevin, welcome to the LAMA podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So what is a medical deep learning company?
We develop clinical applications of artificial intelligence. And so a lot of what we do is working with doctors to understand how do we train an AI to do the same kind of medical process that you do. And then we go out and build those things and then deploy them with hospitals and radiology groups, pharmaceutical companies.
Intriguing. So before we delve into that in some detail, just tell me about yourself and how you got into this. Where did you go to school?
I went to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in upstate New York, right? Changed majors 8 times. Before finally graduating in CS.
I spotted that 8 times. What was the reason? Indecisive as a young man?
I like to try a lot of things, and I'm very fortunate that my varied experiences have turned out to be very helpful in forming insights in AI.
And so what have you studied, and perhaps what were some of those subjects that you decided, well, maybe that's not for me?
Let's see how well I can do here. Game design, electrical engineering, computer engineering, management, physics, applied physics, cognitive science, and then back to computer science.
That was a theme there.
It's all technology, mostly.
So what drew you to establishing this company?
I come from a family that has had a wealth of medical problems. My mother had multiple sclerosis. My grandmother died of lung cancer. We have every kind of cancer that you can imagine in my family history. And so I've always been very close to diagnostics. I've always been very close to technology, especially very advanced research technology. And at the time, I was actually running 2 startups. One was doing natural language processing for resume analytics. The other was developing wearable devices for clinical trials. And when a friend of mine, who I had started a previous company with, introduced me to Jeremy Howard, former president of Kaggle, the machine learning platform, who was working on this vision for Enlytic, I just so quickly fell so deeply in love with it that I just immediately wrapped up what I was doing and came on board to make this my full-time thing.
So let's, as I say, delve a little deeper and figure out how you are going about improving the efficiency of diagnostics.
Well, the first thing I'd say is it's not just about the efficiency. It's also about improving accuracy, and it's about improving access, and it's about improving the expressivity of a lot of the tests that we do today. So how do we make an existing X-ray do more than it could have done before?
Or a blood test. How can
exactly
we learn more from the blood test?
And the way we do that is we've developed a crowdsourcing platform. It's web-based. And we have a team right now of 62 specialist doctors around the world who use that platform in order to annotate medical data for us with very custom and specific guidelines that were crafted specifically to teach an AI how to do what a doctor already knows how to do. And that's how we collect that data that we use to build those models. So one of our core focus areas, for example, is lung cancer detection and diagnosis in chest CT scans. And so we've developed a set of guidelines whereby radiologists in our network can look at several years of CT scans for a given patient, along with knowledge of their patient history and the final outcome of what happened to that patient, a biopsy result. and we ask them to go back in time and circle that nodule. Tell us where it is. Tell us where all of them are, exactly where they are in the scan, in every one that you have, and link them up so that we know how that nodule evolved over time. And then tell us factually, in the end, if this was biopsied, was it benign or malignant? And for everything else that wasn't biopsied, take your best guess, but let us know that it's a guess. And that's how we train the model, with all that information. And the result of that, by doing this very, very rigorous focus on data preparation, is that in internal tests, our models aren't just picking things up more accurately than doctors, they're often doing it up to 2 years earlier than what doctors are, because they've learned their own definition of how a nodule evolves over time. And it happens to be empirically a better definition.
And I think we are, a lot of us are realizing this perhaps more slowly than we should, that the huge potential of the technology that you're talking about. We can develop technologies that are way, way better than doctors. Obviously, you can't get rid of the human being. But the technology that you're talking about has huge to the nth degree potential.
The goal is not to replace doctors. The goal is to augment them. We like to say that it's not about man versus machine. It's about man plus machine. Because either one has their weaknesses. Either one has their strength areas. And together, that's when you get that maximum coverage. I think there will be a point in the distant, distant future when AI so overwhelmingly overcomes accuracy beyond human performance that it might not make sense to have people as involved in the loop, but I think we're a long ways away from there. And in the meantime, we should be focused on how do we get the best of both worlds, because patients should be getting the best of both worlds. I think it's right now what we're seeing, it's a lot like what we've seen the internet do to other jobs. I'm at my heart a software developer, an engineer. My job would have been a lot harder 30 years ago when I couldn't just Google everything and copy code from Stack Overflow. I'm not saying that's what we do at Inlytic, but it certainly makes the life of a software engineer a lot easier when there's this magical AI machine learning system that just knows the most relevant piece of information to serve me at that point in time. I'm still making a judgment call as a developer as to where to incorporate that in my code system. But it did a lot of the heavy lifting for me and made it so that I just need to make that judgment piece. For a while, it's going to be the same thing in medicine, and it probably should be.
To make this, let's say, relevant to people listening to this, suffering from some of the key conditions that affect us as we get old, those killer diseases of old age that we talk about a lot, heart disease, diabetes, what are you doing that can help people here and now?
I think it's important to keep in mind that the step of the process that we're focused on is diagnostics. Most patient journeys begin at that point, in determining that there is something wrong. And ultimately, those things can lead to cures. They can lead to better treatment plans. I think the best example is early detection of things like lung cancer, where catching it 2 years early will make all the difference for a vast, vast majority of patients that have it. There are other diseases that we're very focused on picking up earlier, like glioblastoma multiformes, brain tumors, that clinically, right now, there isn't a whole lot of benefit that could come from detecting it early. But who's to say that we won't figure out the benefit of detecting it early if we simply had more samples where we picked it up early? Maybe the reason we don't know how to treat a GBM early is because we just haven't seen it before the patient died a couple weeks or a month later. And I think that the other aspect of this that's particularly exciting to me is a lot of this is leading research that can then be taught back to the radiologists or the doctors themselves. Like, our model has done that early cancer detection by forming its own rules. We can figure out what those rules are, and then we can make sure that's taught to doctors in med school, so that even without an AI system, they know how to do this the right way.
And the key, obviously, to all of this is the collection of the data, because without the data, you have nothing. Without the doctors around the world and patients around the world seeing those doctors, getting tested, whether it's x-rays or blood tests, you've got nothing to work with. So you've got to bring people to you. Now, how do you do that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It starts with the data. I think the first principle that a lot of people in this field lose sight of is that if you put garbage in, you're going to get garbage out. And so it is critically important to ensure that the data that you are providing to your system is not only plentiful, but high quality. And we work with hospitals and radiology providers and pharmaceutical companies who give us a lot of that historic data. And it's only with our team of radiologists and specialists that we're able to really convert it into a format that makes a lot of sense for an AI to learn from. There are publicly available data sets, and there are publicly available ways that people can tackle these problems. And we're also very focused on making sure that people have the tools that they need to do these things themselves. We actually just released a publication 3 days ago where we showed state-of-the-art results across 14 different diseases on the largest publicly available data set of chest x-rays. And we did that using only that data set, and it took us 2 weeks, and we did it using a publicly available architecture, which we only made three small changes to based on the first principles that this is a medical problem, not an academic problem. And we've given that away because we want people to know that this is something that they can and should be doing themselves.
Many people listening to this might have a sense that they want to do more. They want to provide more data, but feel as if the system, the health system that they are part of, isn't opening the door to that.
It's very unfortunate. That's true. You know, somebody earlier yesterday told a story about how they learned how broken the healthcare system was when they realized that they had to drive 200 miles to deliver a CD containing their husband's patient records to another hospital. That's insane. That very much is the system working against people. Mm. But fortunately, there are enough people actively trying to fix this now that even though it's hard to make the decision because it's all broken now, I don't think it'll be broken for too much longer. And I think it's critically important for patients to understand just how much value they can be bringing to the rest of the world in contributing that data.
Often this is data that maybe is at a patient level you don't think is significant, but probably is.
Yes. And you know, our lung cancer models are a very good example of that because they're trained on tens of thousands of patients, but the vast, vast majority of learning, the part that enables us to do it early, comes from just 2,112 patients. That's all it took to train 2-year early detection of lung cancer. That's pretty meaningful for any individual in that group that they can make that much of a difference for that many people. And certainly having more patients will improve the accuracy beyond that. But it doesn't take that much if you're the right kind of patient and you have the right kind of data.
And those numbers, that's a drop in the ocean. If you think globally, it's minuscule, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
And so you can see the potential if you extrapolate that to gather more data from around the world with different types of populations, mm-hmm. You can see the potential.
Right. And lung cancer is only one convenient example of what we're working on. I mean, we're also focused on prostate cancer, liver cancer, breast cancer, thyroid cancer, and many things that are not cancers. We also build a lot of general anomaly detection models, where if we interpret an x-ray, a chest x-ray, we're trying to tell you if there's any reason at all why a doctor should follow this up. Over time, the model will learn how to vocalize why you should follow it up, but at least in the meantime, it can tell you you should look at this patient for some reason. And that means that every patient that gets a chest x-ray can improve our ability to pick up all of these rare and long-tail abnormalities.
You've obviously got a passion for this. Have you ever had do you have eureka moments, both personally and with your company?
Too many. I'm very passionate about what I do because I feel very blessed that as an engineer, I've found a way into medicine. And I really like that a lot of my job is interviewing specialists, people who are the best in the world at that type of detection, and trying to interview them to understand, how do I break down your mental process that you probably don't even know you're doing and convert that into something that matches the mental process of an AI system? And it turns out that in the process of doing that, you learn it really well. In order to teach a person something, you need to understand it well. In order to train an AI how to do it, you need to understand it really well. And so in my particular field, most of what I do is staying up all night talking to doctors in some other part of the world, trying to understand what aspect of what they do makes them so much better at it than anybody else. One of the specialists that I'm very lucky to work with is a thyroid cancer specialist. That's done in neck ultrasounds, by the way. He's out of UCLA. Now, the average doctor, at least in the United States, has a miss rate on thyroid cancer of around 95 to 98%. As in,
gosh,
most of the time when they biopsy you, it turned out that there wasn't a good reason to biopsy you. This guy has an error rate of 85%, which still sounds high, but that's 5 times more accurate than most people. And that's because he has some very special ways that he looks at this. He has his own research that he's done to empirically show that these are the features that matter in that scan. And it's just super, super cool as an engineer to get to learn all of those things and be forced to understand it well enough to actually express that in guidelines.
We focus on this podcast on longevity, living a long, healthy life. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily lifespan, but health span. Do you think about those things? You're a young guy, but do you think about getting old and perhaps what you can do to affect that process?
Since I've started with Inlytic, I've lost over 120 pounds because I've been very focused on nutrition as, I'd say, a hobby, in that I try to do whatever I can to extend my lifespan. And I come up with all these custom nutritional diets and guidelines for exercise, and I test it to see how well it improves my health. And I'm not just looking to see how much it improves my physical well-being, but also my mental well-being, my spiritual well-being. How do I feel and interact with other people? And I try to see what works best empirically for me, because it is important to me that I live for a while to continue my research and make an impact. I'm going to need my body for a while, and so I do think it's incredibly important to treat it well. I also, as a futurist and technologist, think, though, that I'm among the first generation that will be that will have the choice maybe to live forever if they want to. Because I think technology is just it's just growing so quickly that while it may or may not be likely, that I don't know, it is impossible for me or I think anybody else to rule it out entirely.
You think you are of the generation that will one day have the choice to live forever?
I said it's possible.
It's possible.
Yes.
Yes, of course. But that's in your mind.
It is. And, you know, perhaps that's some naive optimism that keeps me going. But
Why
at the
not?
Very least, I do think that it's, I think with the rate at which we're seeing things progress, especially with developments in artificial intelligence, not just in our area of diagnostics, but in general, the ability to contain information processing and apply it to novel problems means literally every aspect of technological growth is going to expand exponentially compared to what we're used to so far. And it's already been growing exponentially, which means we can't rule out any kind of technological boom. But certainly, I think it's within the realm of possibilities.
So you've been inspired by your work to do a lot of, it seems, self-experimentation in terms of your own health, diet, exercise, I assume. So what conclusions, and you mentioned you've lost a lot of weight. What have you done? What have you changed?
Primarily, I started with the ketogenic diet, so avoiding carbohydrates. And I started adapting that into kind of my own variant of it, learning what foods I respond well to, what I don't. Like, for example, under a ketogenic diet, it's perfectly acceptable to eat some nuts and berry-like fruits. I find, though, that it is not acceptable for me to eat those things because as soon as I taste a little bit of sugar, which I find fruit very, very sweet, it makes me crave a lot more sugar. So, sure, I might only eat a handful of raspberries, but that makes me want to go off and eat, you know, several pounds of pineapple or watermelon, which is mostly sugar and won't have great effects.
That's why most people can't just have one bowl of ice cream.
Exactly. And, you know, I think that the mental aspect of it is often overlooked in dieting. And that's, at least in my opinion, largely why you see a lot of studies around fad diets ultimately show the person gained all the weight back in the end. Because those were just band-aid solutions aimed at fixing some kind of temporary behavior as opposed to enforcing good habits overall. In order to enforce good habits, that's a mental problem. That's something that you need to treat as something that you can fix. And you need to approach it fundamentally in a different way. So a lot of what I do is finding the things I already love and not training myself not to love those things, but finding substitutes for those things that are probably, at least as far as I'm concerned, mostly the same, but don't have those negative effects.
Are you on a ketogenic diet full time?
The variant I go with is the cyclic ketogenic diet, meaning that every week or 2 weeks, depending on how I'm feeling or what results I'm seeing, I might do a cheat day or some kind of binge. I think an interesting finding was that the binges actually do help in that it kind of prevents your metabolism from settling or baselining, but it can hurt if you eat so much in your binge that it undoes the previous week or two of work. So finding that middle ground has been interesting.
On a, let's say, an average day, what would your diet look like? Let's say during your ketogenic phase.
I usually only eat one meal a day. I'm also a fan of intermittent fasting. I find that, at least for me personally, it has a lot of mental benefits. I feel like it helps me think a lot more clearly. And so typically the only meal I eat is dinner. And usually that's predominantly meat, usually 1 to 2 pounds of meat, chicken or steak, and a couple pounds of vegetables.
And what time do you eat that meal?
Usually anywhere between 6 and midnight, depending on the day and what's happening.
And absolutely nothing during the day except water?
Yeah. Well, I also drink Coke Zero.
Coke Zero,
yeah,
okay.
Coke Zero, that's my guilty pleasure.
So a bit of caffeine.
Yeah.
And you feel energized, mentally alert during the day because of that?
I do. And in fact, I find that it makes me feel more mentally clear and more energetic as a result of it. I mean, for anybody else, your mileage may vary. It is purely, this comes with a disclaimer that for me personally, this has given the best effects. But I find that eating things like junk food, eating just even healthy things throughout the day, it makes me more focused on food or something I don't want to be thinking about, as opposed to ignoring that. I get to just focus on what's right in front of me and more important. And I just know that the meal is something that will happen later in the day because it has to, but it shouldn't be the thing that I'm focused on at the time.
Fascinating. You're preaching to the converted here, because I try to settle on two meals a day, two significant meals a day, which tends to work best for me. But I do periodic fasting of a kind where you do five consecutive days of a very, very low caloric intake. And I think we share the same experience of that mental high that you get during that fasting period, which a lot of people find difficult to understand and appreciate until you actually do it. And feel the benefits. Have you quantitatively measured in terms of the effects on you, blood tests, that kind of thing?
I have. And actually, one of my goals for this year is to put out an extensive blog post where I'll detail everything I did. It was predominantly over the course of 1 year that I've lost the 120 pounds and put on a good bit of muscle during that time, too. And I logged every single thing I ate for that amount of time. I took my weight probably once a week, I would say. And I got regularly blood tested and other things. And I'm going to publish all of that data along with this and sort of my own thoughts around what best practices might be.
Is there a headline? There's a lot of detail and I can't wait to read it. But is there a headline that comes out of it that you would share with people?
I don't know that I have a headline for it. It's more something that I would like to be able to send to people when they need help with this. Because I think that my approach to it was very practical. It was very much coming at it from the perspective of an engineer. And I think that maybe I cut some corners in doing that, but ultimately, I think it leads to a lot of best practices that will help people quite considerably by divorcing the academic viewpoint of scientifically fewer calories means losing weight and translating that to, as a person, what does that mean? Where is their wiggle room? And what is the system I should follow rather than a prescriptive, you know, set of do this, then do this? So it might just be a practical approach to weight loss
and
or something.
Are you convinced that your system is sustainable for the rest, presumably for the rest of your life, if it's working for you?
I think it's sustainable for me. But again, everything in nutrition, I think, needs to come with the disclaimer that your mileage may vary. I think nutrition science, unfortunately, does not benefit from the level of rigor that many other fields of science do, largely because of the lack of longitudinal data and because it's impossible to achieve statistical significance when there's a million misunderstood variables. But ultimately, I think it works for me. It's worked for me for a while now. And I think for other people, it is likely to work for them as long as they understand that you don't have to be perfect. You just need to follow a few good guidelines and find what works for you.
Go and see your doctor first. You know, this can be dangerous. Ketogenic diets, changing any kind of diet to something that you're not used to, especially a fasting regime, can be great, but it can also be dangerous, especially for certain people. If you're a nursing mother, if you're underweight, if you've got diabetes, there's a long list of reasons why you shouldn't do these things, and you should absolutely consult your doctor first. Just a closing thought, as you move to the future, what have you got your eyes set on for the next 10 years?
My goal personally is really to advance technology in a meaningful way that will impact a large number of lives. And I think that that's a very general goal, but I think sometimes it's important to be driven more by some kind of moral guideline like that than a specific, I want to accomplish X by Y. And so everything I do is, at least in my mind, with the goal of pushing both of those boundaries, both technologically and for the good of people. And I truly, truly hope to see an exponential boom in my ability to deliver on those things in the next 10 years.
Kevin Lyman, this has been a really fascinating conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And if you'd like more information about Kevin's work, there's a link to Enlytic and Kevin's social media connections on the show notes page for this episode. You'll find them at our Live Long and Master Aging website. That's llamapodcast.com. That's LLAMApodcast.com. You can also get in touch and follow what we do at Llama Podcast on Facebook and Twitter. That's @LlamaPodcast. Many thanks for listening. FlexBeam is a portable red light therapy device that's now being used by leading athletes, including the Norwegian tennis player Casper Ruud.
Whenever you put the FlexBeam on, you feel it starts to work right away. I need something that can help repair all the fibers that I have broken in the serves.
The infrared lights penetrate your skin and makes the muscle tissue recover faster. FlexBeam, I keep it with me all the time.
Recharge Health is offering Llama Podcast listeners an $80 discount on the purchase of a FlexBeam device. Go to the website recharge.health and use the code Llama at checkout. That's LLAMA. You'll also find the link in the show notes for this episode.